Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Welcome back to another Books with Hooks. As per usual, we are going to dive straight in. Cece, will you please read us your first query?
Let's do this. Dear Cece Lira, I am excited to send you my upmarket gothic novel, The Graveyard Tree, complete at 89,000 words. In your manuscript wish list, you expressed an interest in books like Mexican Gothic by Silvia Moreno Garcia, and as this story has a similarly unsettling atmosphere and tone, I hoped it might interest you. The book takes place in a waterlogged New York City of the future where plants have become valuable luxury items and follows a socialite who is forced to move to a dangerous neighborhood after her father loses all their money. In a fight to regain her wealth, she uncovers a series of conspiracies that go back to her mother's disappearance 13 years ago. After her father loses everything, their uptown penthouse, their money, and all her belongings, 19-year-old Shay Atkins and her father move into a cheap rental apartment with only a single yellowing peace lily for company, and Shay is not remotely satisfied with her new accommodation. For one, the apartment is too dark to keep her peace lily alive, and for two, the view of the condemned building across the way leaves her constantly uneasy. Her father, paranoid after his wife abandoned them years ago, forces Shay to stay inside, claiming that the notorious pro-gun gang, the Minutemen, has been sighted in the area. But Shay, determined to keep her standards up and to get her hair done professionally, plans to rehabilitate and sell her lily, the only remaining plant from her formerly legendary collection of rare and valuable plants. But when she goes on the fire escape to get better sunlight, she narrowly escapes attack from the Minutemen. And it becomes clear that the Minutemen aren't just looking for trouble, they're looking for her. What ensues is Shay's struggle to keep herself and the plant alive as she tries to discover why exactly the Minutemen are hunting her. She escapes first into the condemned building and a world of squatters, ostracized for their queerness, and later into the arms of her violent and rich ex-boyfriend. As she searches for a protector, she realizes that neither her father nor her ex-boyfriend have her best interests at heart, and she must decide if she wants to reestablish the Atkins name or fully uproot its rottenness. The Graveyard Tree is a story of a city torn apart by class divides and the climate crisis. I imagine this book being on the shelf with the gently speculative and very unsettling Our Wives Under the Sea by Julia Armfield, Flatiron Books, and The Natural Disaster and Plant-Focused Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton, Fair, Strauss, and Giroux. I am finishing up my MFA in creative writing at the City College of New York and write about queer characters mirroring my own experience. While I have lived in New York City for over a decade, I grew up on a small farm in Vermont where my love of plants began. This is my debut novel, Best India.
Thank you, Cece. I just feel like I need to point out to the author that when it comes to homonyms and homophones, Minutemen could also be read as Minute Men, which is not quite so scary considering they're really minute. So this is something you do want to keep in mind when you name somebody like that, especially on the Jack copy where somebody might mess that up. I remember my husband and I both reading Terry Pratchett years ago, and there was one character whose name was spelled B-R-U-T-H-A, and he was a monk. So I pronounced it brother, but my husband pronounced it Bruta, and the two of us spent hours arguing about how to actually pronounce that. Okay, Cece, what was your take on the query? How many words? And what did you think?
I love that. So the author supplied the word count. This one is clocking in at 503 words. All right, so my notes from the top. As I was reading this for the first time, I started off and heard that this was like Mexican Gothic. And so I thought, oh, this is her comp. And then I thought to myself, oh, we need one more comp. So then I made a little note on the margins. Hey, we need one more comp. But then we got to the end of the letter. And as our listeners could listen to me reading, we do get other comps right at the very end. And so my first note is really quite simple. Bring up your comps. Start your query letter with a paragraph that includes all the metadata. Title, genre, word count, comps, and of course the hook. Why do we ask for comps up top? Why do we ask for that information, you know, right off the gate? It's really because it sets the stage for the plot paragraph. I know that there are other people who prefer to start with plot and then find out at the very end if it's a thriller or if it's, I don't know, literary fiction, then what the comps might be. But to me, it's a missed opportunity for me to really set the stage and know like what I'm going in for. So I would just bring that up. It's something we talk about a lot on the podcast, and in my opinion, makes a huge difference in setting your query letter apart. I would also say that I don't really, like, when I first read this, I was like, okay, the book takes place in a waterlogged New York City of the future where plants have become valuable luxury items. That's interesting. And then we have a socialite who's forced to move to a dangerous neighborhood after her father loses all their money. And I didn't quite see how the two things connected. And it didn't bother me per se, because it was like the very first line that I read about the book. And I was like, it's going to make sense. It's going to make sense. It only actually made sense to me once I read the pages. And so what I would point out to you is bring up the fact that her father had a tree collection or whatever the term is in this world and lost it all. And so that's why they don't have any money. Or else the connection between the two things feels untethered, or at the very least not super clear. And it actually is quite clear in your pages. So I would just make that extra clear in the query letter too. Okay, another thing. I did notice a lot of repetition of the word plants, plants, plants. And I'm like, you can just use flora at one point just to avoid that if you want. The major dramatic question right now, it reads, she must decide if she wants to reestablish the Atkins name or fully uproot its rottenness. And I don't think that's the major dramatic question, because probably the major dramatic question is tied to like saving her life, because these people are after her. And I assume they, like, I just assume that they want to kill her. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that right now the major dramatic question is super internal, and based on all of your description of the plot, this does not seem like an internal focused book. Another thing I will say as a big picture note is this is very wordy. First, all of my empathy Please receive and feel all of my empathy. Because when I'm writing pitch letters to editors, my first drafts are always like 600 words, sometimes more. But then I force myself to cut, cut, trim, trim. And the good news here is that you have a lot to cut. Like, there's just so much unnecessary detail. So for example, you say that her father loses everything, and then you list things like Uptown penthouse, their money, belongings. You really don't need that. And then you have a whole sentence dedicated to the fact that she's not satisfied with the accommodation. But you can just bring up the fact that she's unsatisfied in the sentence where you mention the fact that she lost everything, right? Or the fact that she moved. You don't need the detail about her hair dye. Like, again, in the pages, that makes sense because I've read the pages and they know about it. But you don't need the detail about her hair dye in the query letter. You are just adding way too much. Again, all the empathy. Everyone knows that I am verbose. And so that also happens in writing, but you can't when you're querying. You must trim. It just is what it is. It's one of those situations where you have got to figure out how to be more succinct. So I wish you all the best of luck. As a minor note, I will say that you don't need the publisher's names in parentheses when you're citing comps. So you mentioned Flatiron when you mentioned Our Wives Under the Sea, and that's just an easy way to like cut a few more words. So you really don't need that for comps. It's not a problem if you include it, but since you are pressed for space, I would consider cutting back on that.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, what are your thoughts?
All right. So first of all, I thought that this was potentially YA because Mexican Gothic is an interesting comp, right? Because she isn't super, she's kind of, I can't remember exactly how old she is, but because it's kind of set in the past, she's kind of at that age where she was being potentially set up. I think she was probably like 20-ish, if I remember correctly. And our main character here is 19. So to me, this definitely felt YA. And we can talk about that a bit more with the pages, but I do want to flag that. I definitely agree with Cece. The other big thing that stood out to me was the most important thing in this world is plants. And then in the rest of the hook, we don't mention the plants again. So I'm trying to see the connection between it all as well. So that was a huge opportunity there to connect those two pieces. I think that's really important. Definitely also want to know how he loses everything. Was it gambling or theft or something else, you know, to do with this world? Super, super important. One thing I want to point out in the middle is that I felt we kind of slipped into synopsis territory instead of pitch territory. And I'll tell you exactly when. So our main character is Shay Atkins, our 19-year-old character. In the middle of the body paragraph, you say, her father, paranoid after his wife abandoned them years ago, forces Shay to stay inside. Is this not her mother? Why wouldn't she say, again, if this is her book and this, she is the main character, why wouldn't we say her mother abandoned them years ago? Right? Like, I don't know. To me, it's just the fact that it was like her father paranoid after his wife. That was very like synopsis-y to me. So I think we really need to make sure we're centering our main character always, because this deeply affects her. If you frame it as her father paranoid after his wife abandoned them, it's like she's very removed. Wouldn't she be like, my mom abandoned us? Do you know what I'm trying to say? That's a huge difference in terms of like that deep connection and that wound, that deep mother wound that she has. I think that would be pretty important here. Okay. And so the bit about the hair. Again, this comes up, as Cece mentioned, in the pages as well, but determined to keep her standards up, get the hair done professionally, rehabilitate and sell her lily, the only remaining plant from her formerly legendary collection of rare and valuable plants. The hair piece, I mean, again, this is another thing that makes it seem a bit kind of like quote-unquote juvenile, meaning like YA to me, in the sense that she's so concerned with this, she can't see the larger repercussions of this. I don't know. It just felt like so superficial when we're like in a sci-fi movie that's post-apocalyptic in a world obsessed with plants. We're worrying about hair. I don't know. I guess I just can't understand the character really in this moment to understand why that would be the most important thing. And again, it's always hard when, number one, we don't have the author on the show. And number two, we're reading such a small sample because I don't know where this is going to go. Could she maybe, you know, figure out something in her world where she can dye her hair on her own? Or, you know, like people have used lemon to lighten their hair for, you know, centuries, right? So I don't know. I just felt like I could not see the connection here, which I think there's just some work to do. So the last note that I had in the body paragraph was around the word queerness. So it says she escapes first into the condemned building in a world of squatters, ostracized for their queerness, and later into the arms of her violent and rich ex-boyfriend. I'm just curious about the choice of the word queerness, because really, I think in 2024, this is mostly used as like queer as in gay. So I'm like, do you mean queer as an other in this situation? I don't know. It's just a very it's such a specific word that is used for such a specific purpose. It really took me aback in terms, if it was used in the context of gay, then I'm like, why are the squatters all gay? Like, is that something to do with the world and they were ostracized? Or I don't know. That's just such an important and loaded word. And that choice there was just a bit of a like, ooh, to me, I just didn't feel like it was either used in the right way or had the right kind of like deep meaning, I guess.
Thank you, Carly. Yeah, it's just an indication of how you really need to get the right word, especially in a query letter. It's kind of like poetry, you know, you have to land on the right word to create the right impression. Okay, Cece, what was in those opening pages?
All right, so we have Shay, our protagonist, in the apartment, staring at the building across the street, and she's complaining about her roots to her dad, who assures her that soon they'll have enough money for her to get her hair done. Through dialogue, we learn that her dad works doing manual labor while she's at home all day because he tells her she can't leave. Her lily is dying, which shocks her because it was supposed to be a hardy plant. And through interiority, we learn that she doesn't look like her dad and that her dad used to own a tree collection, and so they had a lot of money, but then her dad's obsession with land cost them everything. And now when he works doing manual labor, his paycheck gets docked every month so that he can repay the debt he has. She asks if they can use money from her collection, and he tells her the bank seized that too. And then she thinks of how when Dom finally sees her again, he will be glad she left him.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, what was your take on the opening pages?
I have a lot of thoughts on this one. I noticed that there was a lot of things that were working, and I did take time to highlight them and go, oh my gosh, this is so great. As always, we try to focus on the things that we think need work just because we want to offer value to you. But I do want to read one line that's really, really excellent and that I thought was absolutely wonderful. So when she is thinking of how she and her dad don't look alike, the line reads, "His face was pleasing in the way a good soap dispenser was pleasing. Its utility and structure made it unnoticeable." So there are some really interesting sharp lines here, which I very much appreciated. At the same time, I wanted more depth, which I feel it was just, you know, a me problem sometimes because I always want more depth. But I'll give specific examples. Her dad is doing manual hard labor. He has to clean the subway tracks of excrement and urine. Right? Like, this is a big, big lifestyle change for this man who used to be wealthy and wear suits. Our protagonist hasn't even ever ridden the subway. Doesn't even know what the subway looks like, essentially. And her dad is in this situation. And through dialogue, she's very hard on him. You know, she's essentially, she cares about her roots. She cares about material things. And meanwhile, her father is clearly in a very tough situation, having to work all day. And I understand that she can't leave the apartment because of him. But again, through dialogue, she's very, very hard on him and doesn't show any type of sympathy or empathy or concern or anything like that. And we do get bodily reactions to show her discomfort, things like biting her lip and wincing, but nothing regarding her interiority. I really wanted to know, how does she feel about her dad doing manual labor? And in my opinion, the interesting reaction, the reaction that would grab me and would grab readers, wouldn't be something as simple as, you know, deep down she felt sorry for her dad, or deep down she felt empathy for her dad. That can be part of it, but I wouldn't stop there. You know, maybe she would feel irritation as well because, you know, he loves to be the center of attention and she thinks this is him making it all about him. I don't know. Maybe she would feel like he is prone to martyrdom. That he did the same thing when her mom left and he made it all about his suffering and that he's probably enjoying himself and how he has to do this manual labor and that he's framing it as hard work. But, you know, he loves being a martyr. Another idea. And again, I'm probably not guessing your character's reaction correctly, but whatever the actual reaction is deep inside her psyche, I wanted to see lots and lots of messy layers. I wanted the first layer, second layer, third layer, and then I wanted messy emotions about all of this. I wanted to see her feel guilt, or maybe her feel guilt because of the absence of guilt. Maybe her wondering if there's something wrong with her. I don't know. And this is just one example. There were several others. At one point, he promises her. He tells her, "I promise." And I got no zooming out to see what promises mean to her. Is he the type who keeps his promise? If so, her internal reaction would be one kind. Is he not the kind who keeps his promise? Then her reaction would be differently. Maybe he is the kind to never have made a promise before. This is the first time he's making a promise. I don't know. We need to zoom out. In dialogue, when you're sharing a small thing, in this case, a father making a promise to a daughter, we need to zoom out to see how this daughter feels about promises in general. What is her socio-emotional framework when it comes to promises? And I could keep going on and on about all this interiority that I wanted because there are so many examples in this really interesting opening scene that made me want to know more. But now I'll move on to my second note, which is really about the way you're framing, or rather not framing, something as a curiosity seed. So the very first paragraph starts with how the Atkins have, you know, the family has really fallen in life. And the last line of the first paragraph reads, "In fact, if Shay was honest, they'd been declining for over a decade, a sinking that began when her mother abandoned them 13 years ago." I see two problems with that last clause. First, you're missing an opportunity for a curiosity seed. You could frame it as a sinking that began 13 years ago, that fated night 13 years ago. I don't know. And then I'd wonder what the hell happened 13 years ago. And then I'd be like, oh my gosh, I'm curious. So perhaps the next paragraph or the next page or two pages later, I don't know, perhaps we would get that answer and then you would really have that puzzle feeling that makes a book so interesting. And then the other thing is also she doesn't think about her mom throughout the rest of the pages, which to me is strange because given that this is probably the second biggest crisis in her life, the first was most likely her mom leaving, she would make parallels to that. She would be like, you know, he's broken, but he's not as broken as he was that other time. Or maybe she is broken, but she's not as broken as she was the first time. Or maybe she's more broken. I don't know. But again, that comparison with this other major event was really missing for me, and I really wanted to see it. I do think that the layers and layers of interiority can do so much here. So I really do encourage you to weave that in and just make the story all that it can, because I think you have a really special story with a lot of potential given the hook.
Thank you, Cece. Before we hand over to Carly, for this author, listen to next week's episode with Claire Lombardo. That was a phenomenal interview in which we really pack interiority and emotionality from the queen of both. Reading Claire Lombardo's work is immersing yourself in both. So get her work, listen to that interview. I'm sure you'll find it incredibly helpful. Okay, Carly, your thoughts?
I think my main note here is I think the dynamic between the daughter and the father is crucial. I think it's the crux of the entire book from what I can see. Their relationship, the intensity of being put in this situation together, it sets itself up for so many opportunities. And I agree, I think the hook is super interesting. Ultimately, I felt like the dialogue was for the reader and not necessarily that it was what would actually have happened between these characters. I don't know. I really felt like it was more performative than it was in the heat of the moment. I don't know. I almost wonder, like, how much have they settled into this world? How much shame does she feel? How angry is she at her dad? Or is it pity? Like, I want to read you one line here. So she says, "Her ancestors had invested in art and industry. That was the Atkins way. But her father had been too stupid to follow the plan that had worked so well for his in-laws. And he'd lost everything. The accounts, the penthouse, the dignity. Everything of hers too, except the peace lily." Calling your dad stupid is a pretty intense way to describe your father. I almost, like, I'm not clear if she's mad, if she's indifferent, does she pity him? I don't know. I just felt like there's so much here that we have, like, left to explore, and we have an entire novel to do it. But the fact that I'm not clear on that position, and her position can change throughout the course of the novel. That's the whole point of the novel. It can develop and grow. But I'm not really sure on her position because he calls her, you know, they talk like baby bird in terms of this, like, you know, endearing language. He calls her baby bird. And he seems to have this, like, huge sweetness for her and this fondness. And so he thinks they have a great relationship. And she just called him stupid. So I'm like, there's clearly a huge disconnect between the way that these two people interact with each other on the page and their feelings towards each other, which leads me to think there's a ton that's not being said. And the author can have all of these answers, of course, but there's a lot that's just not there on the page yet. And I would love to see us go a bit deeper here and really explore how complicated this relationship is. And as I said, what is it the shame? Is it the pity? Is it fear? What are the underlying feelings? Because I do think the premise is really strong.
All right. Thank you so much, Carly. Right. We are now going to go to our second query letter. Will you read that for us, please?
Dear Carly Waters, CC Lira, and Bianca Murray, after following your weekly podcast and incredible and informative Instagram accounts that are all collectively and accessible in astounding masterclass in writing, I would be so grateful to get your feedback on my 95,000-word multi-POV upmarket fiction, Let's Start a Commune. Readers who enjoyed the female friend dynamics of Cynthia Dupree Sweeney's second novel, Good Company, and those who hunger for the layered stories and relatable voice of Leah Moriarty will love my novel that deals with our collective desire to leave the complications of our lives behind. 2 years after May, Thomas, and their three kids resettle from Toronto to an abandoned family farm in Normandy, France, life is starting to fall into place. That is, until their friends from back home arrive unannounced on their doorstep. That had been the original plan 5 years ago, but a lot has happened since, including a drunken night leading to mistakes May is desperate to put behind her, and a promise made that her husband can never know about. The kids, too, have truths that the new arrivals threaten to reveal as they each try to find their place in this life they've been thrown into, for better or worse. Managing neighbors on either side, an alluring woman and her nephew who barter for goods, and a grumpy old dairy farmer, May insists, is harmless, as well as the increasingly unreliable elements that threaten their sustainable lifestyle. Tensions mount between the two families. When the revelation of what happened that night back in Toronto can no longer be kept under wraps, May must protect her children, her marriage, and the escape she planned so carefully, and the two families are left to decide whether the life they aspire to create is worth fighting for, or whether it's actually a nightmare in disguise. I hold a bachelor's degree in English literature, and I'm a massage therapist by trade, a mom/stepmom of a chaotic and beautiful blended family, make chocolate dioramas in the winter, and wrangle one dog, one cat, and soon a small flock of backyard chickens in my home of Guelph, Ontario. I wrote the majority of this novel after volunteering at an organic dairy farm while helping to homeschool my stepson. I'm currently working on my next novel, my upcoming website and newsletter. Thank you so much for taking the time to consider the first 5 pages of my manuscript. Please accept my endless gratitude for any feedback you're willing to provide. Sincerely, Britt Hayes.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, so that query came in at 430 words. Will you give us your take on it?
Let's start with the title. Always my favorite place to start. Okay, let's start a commune. Commune has very strong connotations to, obviously, the cult world and all of that sort of stuff. Reading the pitch, I don't really get the sense that they are trying to necessarily like start a whole off-the-grid community, because they are in Normandy and have neighbors. So that was a bit of a like, I don't know if that's the right word choice there. I like the let's start a part. It's the commune part that's tripping me up. I also feel like we did see a flood of cult and commune books probably about 5 years ago. So I don't know. It just wasn't like screaming like fresh to me in the title. The Comp, Good Company. I loved this book. I don't think it was as widely read as The Nest. I think it should be. I think Good Company was a great book. And the next comp, you say, the layered stories and relatable voice of Leah Moriarty. Okay. I'm interested in the choice of comp here because personally, and this could just be my interpretation of the way that I read her work, but I don't think she's best known for her relatable voice. Like, I think she's more known for being like a master in storytelling and keeping secrets from the reader, not necessarily a relatable voice. So I thought that was a bit of an interesting choice to comp. So I'm thinking maybe you need to comp to a book of hers, not her herself, would potentially be the best way forward here. I felt like the word resettle was a bit of an interesting choice, because resettle to me means like re-meaning to do again, settle in Normandy. So were they originally from France or Normandy, and then they are kind of going back to Normandy? I get the sense, I don't know, like reset, or just like to resettle, meaning they were settled in Toronto and then we are settling again in a new place. I don't know. I tripped over that a little bit, but that could definitely just be me. Okay, so now my next three notes are vague, this could be anything. So I think in this attempt to have a Leanne Moriarty type of you know, we're not going to tell the reader everything. We're going to, hide behind some of this carefully worded language. We're falling into that trap of not telling us anything, because a drunken night leading to mistakes. What mistakes? Desperate to put behind her. Why? Truths that the new arrivals threaten to reveal. Reveal what? And then for better or worse. Those are some examples of some pretty vague wording. And I understand, again, you're trying to hide the what happens or the climax. And this is the hardest part of the query letter, is doing the dance between how much you have to tell us and if you're not telling us enough. And I feel like you're not telling us enough. So obviously just want to let you know that. I would try to make it a bit more clear that it's the weather elements, you say, as well as the increasingly unreliable elements that threaten their sustainable lifestyle. A lot of things could threaten a sustainable lifestyle. Elements could be elements of commerce or capitalism, right? So elements, I think you maybe need to say, like, explain it's like the weather elements specifically. I think that would help here. I also feel like we're missing the huge why, which I think is buried in this drunken night and needing to escape and secrets we need to reveal, which is, why are they leaving? Why are you uprooting your, because we learn in the pages that some of the kids are, one of them I think is 17. They're pretty old to just like uproot your entire life and move for sustainable living. I'm like, you can live sustainably in Toronto to a certain extent. You can live in a lot of places sustainably. Why do we have to move to Normandy? What about Normandy says sustainability? I don't know. I have a lot of question marks around like the, is it environmentalism? Is it a facade? You know, we're trying to cover up for something else. I would love to know the why here, because I feel like sustainability can often be used as like a greenwashing term, right? It can just be like sustainable this, sustainable that. Like what about it is sustainable? Right? We understand later it's the living off the land part, which we get in the pages, but why do they want to live off the land? This is some of the things that I wanted to know in much more depth.
Thanks so much, Carly. Okay, Cece, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with everything Carly said. And just to build off that, to me, as I was reading this, part of me was thinking, oh, yay, neighborhood drama, secrets threatening to spill out, you know, each multi-PUV, like, yay. Like, I love all that in terms of ingredients. But your paw paragraph is withholding too much. Lots of empathy for that, because it's hard to know when to withhold, when to reveal. But I also agree that you should definitely reveal more. It might help to frame it through each of the POVs. So, you know, you have May, but then you don't give us too much on everyone else. And so if you take a look at, I think even an example here, The Whispers by Ashley Audrain, I'm pretty sure that the pitch copy for that has the line on each person, even though they might not name each person, which is fine. And I know you have things like the kids too have truths that the new arrivals threaten to reveal. But again, this is just like the kids. You know, it would be interesting to see you have the eldest who is going through this struggle. You have the youngest who is going through this other struggle. And that might help make the plot more specific and more clear. Because I get that you can't reveal what happened all those years ago, but we need something that's happening in present day, plot-wise, very external. We need rising action after that, and we need it to lead up to a climax. So it definitely feels like a super fun book that I'd want to read. I'm not sure you're framing it in the right way.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, will you tell us, Carly, what was in those opening pages?
All right, so we start with our prologue in May's point of view. It says May 17th in Normandy, France. We are in a very dramatic moment here in the prologue where there is blood everywhere. It says blood's filling May's nose. They're in the barn. There's blood everywhere. It seems like multiple kids are in the barn with them. The husband's in the barn with them. We're not clear, and I think this is the point, is trying to figure out whose blood it is. And then at the end, Tomas says it's not her. So we get the sense where it's a lot of blood, potentially an animal, not a child, but a very dramatic scene where clearly something has gone wrong. Then we go to chapter one in May's point of view as well. We're moving back in time toward, it's May 2nd, again in Normandy, France. May is talking about how much she would want a cup of coffee, an Americano style one. She's clearly missing some of the things that she had back home. We're learning a bit about the farm, what conveniences they've given up versus what they've gained. And we know that they kind of have a farm. They get up early, kind of tending to the animals. It's her day to sleep in. And her husband has gone out to take care of the animals and has come back in.
Great. Okay, first things first. What do we think of the prologue?
So I think this is what is trying to be Leanne Moriarty, which is incredibly dramatic, not telling us much of anything. And in a lot of cases for her, I mean, it works, obviously, right? And so I think this is what we're potentially trying to emulate, which is the prologue is May 17th, and then the book itself starts on May 2nd. So we know a few weeks into the future, something very dramatic is happening, something potentially with the animals, something like that. So I it does set it up really well in the sense that I really wanted to know if it was the child that got hurt, because obviously a child being hurt is very dramatic. We obviously don't want animals to be hurt as well. We don't want anybody to be hurt, but we want it, like, what is the source of the blood? It's kind of the main dramatic question of the prologue. What is the source of the blood? And the child says, mommy, and then it's like May, so we're like, ah, and the child's covered in blood. And then we later find out it's probably from
something else. So I think it's a pretty dramatic prologue. It's not one of those prologues where I'm like, is this trying to be a car crash? You know, like, oh, trying to overdo the dramatics. It is realistic to the world. They're on a farm. Farm accidents happen. That is a reality of being on a working farm. You know, any country folk like myself know that, right? So I could see that this is a very real moment. And so it did not feel like it needed to be something else. It felt like a very dramatic farm injury moment. And so I really did feel that. I think it ultimately works. And it also sets up the 3-week countdown, essentially, to figuring out what happened. So I think it works. And then chapter one. Okay, so I think this is where I needed the big why, because we get the sense like she really misses this coffee. But then you're like, okay, well, if you miss your coffee so much, why did you move to the middle of nowhere in France? And then she's like, okay, there is coffee in France, but you know, I want that coffee. And so she's doing that whole, what did I give up versus what did I gain? I'm hugely curious about the why here. And I know sustainability and the environment is a global human issue, but for an individual to uproot their entire life, again, what is it that happened there? I think what I'm just worried about is that it's coming off super quiet. And we know that something happened back in Toronto, presumably, that made her want to run away. But we need on the page to know, like, eventually, you know, you might tell us in future pages, what is the big event? You know, what happened? Like, can we allude to it? Can we drop some sort of hint? Because if she's just on her high horse about sustainability, that's a personality trait that is one way. If she is trying to escape something and run away from something and using sustainability as a facade, that's another type of personality trait. So I guess I'm just curious about where she falls. And I don't feel like I understand her because I can't really answer that question about the why of it all. So I think it's reading a bit quiet. And I think it's just because we're hiding some things.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, your thoughts?
I agree that the prologue works, but I don't think we need as many names as we're currently getting. I also wasn't clear at the very end when Tomas says it's not her, whether he meant it's not her blood or it's not her, the child. There's just a lot of names and it really confused me and I had to read it twice and I was still confused. So I do like the idea of that kind of prologue. I would just perhaps, I guess, clarify it a little bit more, tighten it a little bit more. Chapter one, okay, so this is hilarious because I loved the first paragraph. I was like, this is a very strong opener, strong writing, strong, sharp feeling, really, you know, in the moment, her wanting coffee. And then she kept thinking about the coffee for pages and pages and pages. And at one point I even wrote, she is in France. Coffee in France is superior to coffee in the States. It just is. Why can't she get coffee? And then finally, after pages and pages and pages, we understand that it's a self-imposed rule because she is worried about sustainability. Cool. I like that I'm getting my own answer. But I'll be honest, all of this could be a paragraph. Like, we do not need pages and pages and pages of her comparing her old life to her current life. In my opinion, you're doing the catch-up thing. You know when you have episodes on TV shows that go previously on blah, 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 and then they catch you up so that you can start in the moment in the new episode? You're doing the previously on thing. Stop doing the previously on thing. She can think about the coffee. She can miss the coffee. She can compare it to her old life. That's good. That's interiority. But it can't be what we do for all these pages. And it's what we're doing for all these pages. We're comparing her old life to her new life. It's very well done. It's very interesting. You're a strong writer, but it's just taking too long. I wanted to be immersed in story forward plot, not in stuff that she left behind for so long. So again, these are my two cents. I think that you shouldn't be focusing on this. I think you need to compress, 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 and then add all sorts of present day plot with story forwardness.
All right. Thank you, Carly and Cece, as always, for your incredible insights. Much appreciated. Let's now go to today's guest.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky, though, to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently.
There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. We want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Hello, listeners. This is Cece. Question for you. What do all the very best stories have in common? The ability to make us feel. Which is why learning how to weave emotions into your writing is so important. And I am so excited to announce that I am teaching my super popular writing emotion class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, August 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time via Zoom to learn all about the craft of writing emotions, common mistakes, tips and tricks, and lots of practical examples from novels and memoirs you love. Then we'll meet again on Monday, August 12th, for a live cozy Q&A session in which you will have the option to turn on your camera and ask questions in real time. If you can't attend one or both sessions live, make sure to sign up because everyone who is registered before August 8th will get recordings 24 hours later. For more information, head to my Instagram profile and click on the link in my bio. I hope to see you there.
Today's guest is a young adult author based just outside Toronto. After a blink and you miss it career as a journalist and 8 years as an elementary school teacher, she spent 6 glorious years as a stay-at-home mom before the spark to write came back with a vengeance. Her main female characters are always Palestinian-Canadian, like herself, and more often than not, autistic. Her books lean heavily on romance and tend to be character-driven while tackling the angst of coming of age in a funny, light-hearted, and hopefully relatable way. She's passionate about positive representation and believes marginalized people should be the ones to tell their stories. When she's not writing, you can find her in her suburban kitchen with headphones on, tuning out her family while feeding them their multiple meals a day. Her debut novel, Something More, about a Palestinian-Canadian girl who receives an autism diagnosis just weeks before starting high school, came out last June. She has 2 more YA romances slated to release in 2025 and 2026. It's my pleasure to welcome Jackie Kalalia. Jackie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I know you don't often have a lot of young adult authors on the show.
Yes, yes. It's something that we don't have a lot of, and I really, really want to correct that. It is incredible to get to speak to you today. Right. So for our listeners, before we begin chatting with Jackie and getting her awesome insights, I just want to read you the jacket copy so that you know what we are talking about. So Something More is the book that we are discussing. 15-year-old Jessie, a quirky loner obsessed with the 90s, is diagnosed as autistic just weeks before starting high school. Determined to make a fresh start and keep her diagnosis a secret, Jessie creates a list of goals that range from acquiring two distinct eyebrows to getting a magical first kiss and landing a spot in the school play. Within the halls of Holy Trinity High, she finds a world where things are no longer black and white and quickly learns that living in color is so much more fun. But Jessie gets more than she bargained for when two very different boys steal her heart, forcing her to go off script. This was such a fun read, Jackie. Just, it gave me a lot of Never Have I Ever vibes. When you pitched this originally, I would love to go through your whole journey to publication and what comps you used. But yeah, it gave me the giggles. There were the really heartfelt, heart-rendering moments as well, and a character that we don't often see represented. So can you take us through the journey to publication and if Never Have I Ever inspired you at all?
Well, I believe that when I started writing this, I hadn't yet watched Never Have I Ever. So I began writing something more in January of 2019. It was a New Year's resolution to myself. I had gotten the idea to write a book in 2018, but I had told myself that I wasn't allowed to start writing it until I gave it time to grow in my head, so that when it came time to open the laptop, I wouldn't just be staring at a blank screen and give up. Because there had been a couple times when I had thought I was going to write a book, and I went in, and a couple pages later, it's like, okay, that was fun, and then I walked away. So in January 2019, I felt ready to begin, and it was a lot of the things that brought me to that point. I think most significantly, I was at a crossroads in my life. My youngest was going to be going to full-time kindergarten in the fall, and I knew that I had to make a decision. Was I going to return to my job as a teacher, which I really didn't want to do, or what was I going to do next? And I think because I had, you know, my mind open to next steps, I was able to receive things and really think about what I wanted the next part of my life to look like. And because my children were at the point where they were sleeping through the night and I had my evenings to myself, I was starting to consume media again, which I hadn't done for a while. You know, in the early stages of motherhood, it's just, you don't do anything for yourself. And I remember watching Love, Simon, which is based on a very popular young adult novel. And I remember coming to the end of that movie and having just the warmest, coziest feelings, and remember like wanting to chase that feeling. And I remembered that I had those feelings when I was a teenager watching movies mostly by John Hughes, who I had a special interest in growing up. And I think that was a big catalyst for me because I wanted to chase that feeling. And I think I had a moment one day where I was like, oh, but maybe I could be the one to create those kinds of stories. So that was a big catalyst for me.
Yeah, we'll discuss your dedication, which I really loved. So it says, to my autistic readers, we learn early on to mask, to transform into what we think people want us to be without even realizing what we're doing, often putting ourselves at risk of burnout. Writing the story healed me in so many ways, and I hope, even if it's just in bits and pieces, you will see parts of yourself reflected in Jessie. As far back as I can remember, I felt different from everyone else, but I didn't understand why. My diagnosis was both a relief and a validation. Please remember you are worthy of friendship, love, success, acceptance, and a happy ending. So I feel like a lot, well, I may be wrong, but I feel like you drew on a lot of personal experience while writing this book, and certainly that inspired a lot of it.
Yes. What's interesting is another big catalyst that led me to writing was I was in my garage attic one day pulling out decorations, and I opened my high school box and I landed in front of my journals, and I was reading my high school journals and laughing to myself because I had completely forgotten about some of those moments. But the second I read the entries, I was brought right back to those experiences, and suddenly I was angry and I was giddy and I was sad, and I could remember exactly how I felt. And I remember saying to myself, if I ever write a young adult book, I need to refer to these journals because they put me back in that headspace, and they reminded me that when you are that age, when you are 13 to 19, every single thing just feels huge and important. So that was the start of it. I did not know I was autistic when I first started writing this book. That came a couple drafts in. So while the story, and remember, this was my first book ever, so I didn't know what I was doing. And my only goal when I began was to get to the end. I didn't look at craft books. I didn't do any research, which I think, looking back, benefited me, because I don't think I let myself get too overwhelmed by all the rules. I just spit the story out of my head. And so I think canonically, Jessie was always autistic because I was writing her based on a lot of my own experiences. But my daughter was diagnosed as autistic while I was writing the story. And when I was in the room with the psychologist, it was just like alarm bells came off, because everything that she was describing that my daughter was feeling and experiencing based on the sessions she had with her were my experiences growing up as well. And I didn't know, I had no idea that my daughter was autistic. And I taught kindergarten, and I had autistic boys in my class, but I had never had, to my knowledge, an autistic girl in my class. So I didn't know what girl autism looked like. And so her diagnosis led to me getting a diagnosis. And then once I learned that about myself, I steered the direction of the story to make it, it was always coming of age. A lot of the heart of the story is the same from the early drafts, but it gave it more of like a focus that this was a girl who had just received an autism diagnosis, and we were going to see her process the internalized ableism, the coming to terms with it, whether or not she wanted to tell people. And it really mirrored my own experience, because I was also coming to terms with my diagnosis. There was a point where I wasn't sure if I was even going to publicly tell people that I was autistic, because I had to process it in my own time. And a lot of that came through writing the story.
Yeah, I think you can feel that in the pages. You know, there's an authenticity there that was incredible. We're going to discuss some more in terms of giving a character something they need straight out the gate, giving them wants that drive the action, that are linked to stakes, which you did so very well here. Before we discuss that, can you just take us through how long did it take to land an agent? What did your querying process look like? How long after that did it take before you were able to sell the book? Because our listeners always love hearing debut authors speak about their journey to publication.
Okay, I will warn you, my querying process was really messy. As an autistic person, I'm very impulsive, and I go into things sometimes without doing my due diligence and preparing and waiting for the right time. So it only took me, which still surprises me to this day, about 3 months to draft the first draft of Something More. And then I didn't know what to do. That's when I started looking into like what it takes to publish a book. I eventually learned that you want to work with critique partners and then beta readers. And I found my critique partner, I believe like in July of 2019. And we went back and forth. I helped her. She helped me. And then in January 2020, I thought I was ready. And I wrote a terrible query letter, because I find those so incredibly hard to write. And I started querying, and I went right out the gate and queried my top choice. That's number one. And he was a very fast responder, and I got my first rejection really quickly as well. And so I queried maybe a handful of agents before I realized the query letter needed some work. So I worked with the Query Shark, and she helped me get my query letter in a better shape. And then back in March, I started to query again. And I entered pitch contests on Twitter as well. And I was doing okay. I was starting to get requests. And it just, something wasn't working with the story. And I didn't know what. And I tried to, expand my beta readers, and I was reading craft books. I just couldn't figure out what it was. It is to this day a quieter story, but I think before. It was really quiet and it didn't have the stakes. What happened eventually is I wrote the sequel to Something More, which will never see the light of day. And then I wrote a third book, which I knew was more high concept and had higher stakes and would get the attention of agents more than Something More did. So I had decided to shelve Something More and start querying the third book. While I was querying the third book, one of the agents who still had Something More, who I had emailed to say, you know, I'm pulling this, came back with a really long pass explaining why he was passing and giving me ideas. And I was just, at the time, I was so over the book. I was just like, well, that was nice of him. And then I just, you know, shoved it aside and was so focused on book three. And then in December of 2020, I had this moment where it just clicked. His feedback just clicked. And I was like, I know what to do to fix the book. And what that was, for anyone who's read it, was incorporating Jessie's list of goals and giving her big goals and small goals. And I felt like that is really what grounded the story and it helped move her from one step to the other. And so that was all like, that was from his suggestion. So in December of 2020 into January of 2021, I started to rewrite it. I was still querying book three. I'd gotten two R&Rs for book three and I had submitted those. So while I was waiting to hear back, I revised Something More again. I did end up getting an offer for my third book, and that was March 2021, and I signed with my agent then. So even though she signed me, she said, this book still needs work, which was fine. I agreed because I was getting a lot of requests for that book, but once again, something wasn't working. So we talked on the phone about how we were going to revise that book, and I said, hey, by the way, I just finished revising the book of my heart. Would you like to have a look at it? So she read Something More while I went to work on my third book. She loved it. She gave me some notes. I tweaked it again and we went on submission in March of 2021. And I got my offer, official offer in September of 2021, but we had known there was interest. Well, she knew there was interest in July, but she didn't tell me until August, I think, because they had told her it was going to second reads. And yeah, so looking back, my submission process wasn't that long, but it felt long. And I had only subbed to 13 editors, and it was lucky number 13 that saw Something and Something More and made the offer.
There's so much to love here because I know so many of our listeners have worked relentlessly on the book of their heart, which is generally their debut. Then they send it out and it just isn't working. They can't figure out why it's not working and they shelve it and they move on and they move on. And so it goes. So I think for many of them, it's going to be really encouraging to hear that this is how it happened for you, because sometimes we can't figure out what's wrong with the book. Sometimes it just doesn't matter how much we panel beat it. We can't get it into shape. And sometimes, like you say, all it takes is for one person to respond to an email in which you weren't even nudging. You were just saying, you know, I'm pulling the book. You don't even have to look at it. And then they sent you this incredible, you know, feedback. And even then it took time for that feedback to percolate, right? So for our listeners, I'm always saying bum in chair, but bum in chair is when you're ready to write. A lot of the time, the best writing happens when we are not bum in chair, when we are thinking about things and letting things ferment and simmer as we try and figure out what was wrong. And with this book, and I think especially with YA, you know, I read quite a bit of YA, although I don't interview a lot of YA authors on the podcast, is with most books, you need wants. You need things straight out the gate that the character really wants. And it doesn't have to be huge things like saving the planet. It doesn't have to be saving the world. It just has to be things that matter to that character and that there are stakes tied to it, because that immediately gives them agency. It gives them impetus, and we can understand why they make the decisions they make as they go in pursuit of those goals. So for our listeners, can you just take us through that process of figuring out straight out the gate what her wants were, but more importantly, what the stakes were tied to those wants? Because we see it a lot with emerging authors that they don't seem to be able to tie stakes to wants.
Part of me finessing my writing and storytelling and finding the plot was learning and reading Save the Cat writes a novel. I didn't, like I said, I didn't use anything when I first drafted. And then I went to a bunch of resources, and that's the one that really appealed to me because it's short, direct, there's graphs. And so I used that to sort of reverse revise and see where were the plot points, where's the catalyst, where's all of these things, and where is it not, and what do I need to add? So I think that really helped me, because one of the questions is, what does your character want, right? And she wants a lot of things, and it changes throughout the story. Yeah, and I think, you know, the stakes might feel quiet or not that important to an outside reader, but for Jessie, they're so important. So it was really important for her to set these goals and go after them. And I think part of that, especially in the beginning, is she believes that setting these goals and writing in her journal is going to help her get what she wants in a way that she's not expecting. You know, she decides early on, one of her goals is to hide her autism diagnosis. So she makes that a goal. And as the story progresses, she starts to share with other people that she's autistic, and her goals start to shift and change shape, and so do the stakes. And I think with any character, that has to happen, right? Otherwise, they stay stagnant. And so what she wants and the stakes are always going to sort of change, and you want to see how the character adapts to those changes. And everything feels so important when you're a teenager, and I think there's so much emotion with Jessie especially that sometimes she doesn't react in the best way, or because of her autism, she has to experience something multiple times for it to really get into her head, like her back and forth relationship with one of the love interests, which some readers find really frustrating, especially because they pick up the book thinking it's a romance, and it has a romance storyline to it, but we're looking at it from an autistic person's point of view. And so the romance storyline isn't going to necessarily follow those plot beats that a typical or a neurotypical romance novel would. So I think with a character who has goals and stakes, it's always going to shift. And it also depends on who the character is.
So much to unpack there, Jackie. So I really want to point out to the readers, emphasize what Jackie said, is that one, what the character wants at the beginning of the story doesn't have to be what they want throughout. In fact, if what they want at the beginning of the story is actually something that is not good for them, that's even better, because at the beginning she wants to hide this autism diagnosis from people. And as readers, we know that in order for her to have authentic connections with people, she needs to be honest about who she is, and she needs to accept herself and not feel like this thing is a shameful secret she needs to keep. So straight out the gate, we know she wants something that isn't actually good for her. And so it's really good when what she wants changes as the story changes, because that's part of her character arc, proving that who she is at the end of the story is very different to who she was at the beginning of the story. When you said some readers were frustrated by that particular plot point, it made me realize that I wanted to ask you earlier, when it came to beta readers, did you feel like you needed to have beta readers who also had been diagnosed with autism so that they could understand the story? Was it important for you to have beta readers who didn't have any understanding of what this experience was like? What was that feedback like? And did you sometimes find it frustrating because people were coming at it from a different angle that maybe frustrated you because you were like, this is not how my experience is?
I did not at the time set out to find autistic beta readers or critique partners. And I don't know, to be honest, if that would work for me, because my experience as an autistic person is my experience as an autistic person. And I've joked about this before, but some of my harshest critics are Palestinians and Arabs and fellow autistic people. And I think part of that sometimes is, one, we're so thirsty for representation that when we finally get it, we become disappointed when it doesn't mirror our own experience. So there's that. And then there's the fact that I am not less autistic or less Arab because my experience doesn't match yours. And I did in the beginning receive critique from fellow Arab readers who thought that Jesse's family wasn't Arab enough. And as the person who wrote a very personal story, I feel kind of attacked by that because it's telling me I'm not enough. And I've read that the autism isn't enough or it's exaggerated. And I'm just like, this is my experience. So I don't necessarily seek out Arab or autistic critique partners or beta readers. I have had the experience when I was on sub, I had received an R&R from one editor. And this stuck with me because it really hurt me. The editor said to me, I want you to read a book by Talia Hibbert, who is also an autistic author, because basically the editor is saying she knows how to write autism. And I was just so taken aback by that. Sometimes, you know, as an autistic person, it takes me a while to process what people are saying. And so when I sat with it for a while, I became angrier because I was like, who are you to tell me what my experience should look like? And comparing me to another author, which she's great, but that's her experience. And she's writing through her own lens as an autistic person. And so I think there are moments like that where I do become frustrated based on some of the comments from editors or critique partners or betas where they're saying, for example, the back and forth relationship with one of the male love interests was, okay, we get it. Do we really need to see them have another conversation where she goes back to him? And I would have to say yes, because in my experience as an autistic person, I form deep attachments to people. And it takes me a really long time to process whether that relationship is healthy or not and how to walk away from it. And that was very intentional in my storytelling. Some people, when they critique that, they say it slows down the pace or it drags down the pace, and they don't realize what they're actually saying when they say that. But everything that I did in terms of her behaviors was very purposeful, because that's the key thing as well. I wanted to show autism on the page. It was very important to me as a writer not to tell readers that this was autism. When Jesse would run to the bathroom to cry, I never said to have a meltdown or to have, you know, or this is autism, she's having an autistic meltdown. I would just show that she would get upset and run to the bathroom and cry, because I didn't, it's not my style personally to spoon feed the readers and explain to them that, oh, this is autism, circle that on the page. No, I hope that the readers will see it for themselves. And sometimes they don't. And that's, I guess, part of the risk of not telling too much as a writer.
Yeah. And we're always saying, you know, show as much as possible rather than telling. And that's something you did so incredibly well here. We're almost at the end of our time, Jackie. So one sort of last question is, when you're writing YA, as you said earlier, at that age, everything feels so urgent. It feels, it's like you're walking around with all your nerve endings on the outside. Everything cuts deep. Everything feels big. So your advice to those who are writing YA, how do you include that emotionality, that interiority, so that the reader feels like they're going on an emotional journey with your character, feeling all these highs and lows? What's your advice there on doing that?
You know, we've all been teenagers. Anyone who gets to 20 has been a teenager. And I think sometimes we forget what an emotional roller coaster it is. And so if you are able to channel that time period in your life when you're writing your characters, I think that's really great. Like, I had my journals, so I had a bit of a cheat sheet to remind me of how intensely I felt things. Plus, as an autistic person, I feel things really intensely as well. And just in general, I think I remember that time period of my life more clearly than some people do, because like for Jesse, it was such a transformational moment in my life. I had been at elementary school with the same people for 10 years, and I was just so ready to get to the next chapter and meet my people and have those new experiences. And so I think reading other books by young adult authors will also help you get back in the frame of mind of a teenager as well. Reading is always a great thing to do. Watching teen movies always helped me. Chasing what it is, what do you like? For me, I'm always chasing the warm and fuzzy feelings. And that's what I do when I write. So I think it's I think it's in there. You just have to you just have to channel it.
Yeah, you need to tap into it, and it needs to be on the page. You know, I feel like on the podcast, we're always talking about emotionality and interiority for all books, any kind of fiction, whether it's thrillers or rom-coms or literary fiction. But I think with YA, that's something that you need to tap into even more and have it even more on the page, because that is what YA readers are coming for. You know, they're coming for all the feels, and they want to feel seen, and they want to feel understood, and that they're not the only ones who are going through whatever they're going through.
And that's so important, right? Because that's something, that's the number one positive feedback I get from readers, is that they feel seen, that they wish they had this book when they were younger. And it's funny, because my agent once said to me, she said, "You write the things that people think but would never say out loud." And I took it as a compliment, because it's like, I want to be honest about the feelings, because most of the time they're universal, and why not put it out there? Because as soon as you read something and you connect with it on the page, then you are, half the work is done, right? You're like, I'm invested. I want to see what this character is going to be put through, because I see myself in this character. And that is ignoring gender, race, abilities, right? Like, we're all human at the end of the day, underneath all of that. And we have a lot of the same emotions and feelings and experiences.
Perfect place to end. Thank you so much, Jackie. For our listeners, we're linking to Something More on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get the book there, you support an independent bookstore, you support the podcast, and you support Jackie at the same time. Jackie, good luck with the next book, and we hope to chat to you again then.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program, and our conversations have been edited and condensed, and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation.
This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.